rocket ship. Off we go on a trip, heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi everyone, my name is Anne, and I'll be your host for my science project today, February 7th, 2008. And we've got a mishmash of things lined up today. As you might know, if you've been listening to CITR lately, it is Black History Month, and a lot of reasons to celebrate and a lot of people to celebrate when it comes to African Americans and Black scientific researchers and inventors. And so we'll spend a little bit of time looking at some of the incredible contributions against all odds of some Black scientists and inventors. Also, I've got a little thing on ladybugs because I've got a little personal soft spot for ladybugs. So a little bit of story on that. Also coming up, a little bit of an introduction to laboratory moonshine and the hazards of making your drinks with lab products. A whole whack of events going on in the city. And yeah, a little bit of music to stitch it all together. So thanks for joining us. This is My Science Project, and I'm your host, Anne. We're on the air here every second Thursday, and it's alternately hosted by me and my comrade, Julia, who comes to you from Calgary. So we give you a good dose of West Coast science and technology and try to keep it local as much as we can. But looking outside of the provinces of British Columbia and Alberta, this week marked the end of an era as Josh Lederberg passed away at the age of 82. He is widely praised for his integrity and his intelligence as a scientist, and he is absolutely accredited with having shaped the field of bacterial genetics. Bacterial genetics was formerly a field that was really losing steam or dying out due to the fact that it had more or less been concluded that bacteria did not reproduce by mating, and therefore genes were not transferred between bacteria. Didn't appear that there was too much to continue learning. But for work that would eventually win him the Nobel Prize in 1958, Lederberg demonstrated that bacteria can reproduce by mating, and thus exchange genetic material. Lederberg founded the Department of Medical Genetics at the University of Wisconsin, and later at the Stanford University Medical School, and then he went on to become president of the Rockefeller University from 1978 to 1990. And for those of you who work with bacteria, you'll probably also recognize the contribution that Lederberg has made to the technical aspects of your field, because he had a hand in developing such commonly used tools as replica plating, indirect selection of drug-resistant mutants, and limited and general transduction. So that's Josh Lederberg, who passed away just this week. It's a sincere loss for the scientific community. So what I'm going to do just now is line up a little bit more music and see what you think. We'll be right back. Was Mad Professor and a tune called Slice of the Pie. You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And as I mentioned earlier on, it's Black History Month. And so I want to take a little bit of time out of today's show to take a look at a couple of current issues in terms of race in science and health and medicine, as well as to take a quick look at a handful of Black scientists and inventors who have made an extraordinary contribution with a strong odds stacked against them to science and technology in our society. So what could be said is that genetic studies have always held that race is only skin deep. And that comes from a look at a comparison between DNA sequences. For example, if you compared your DNA to someone who's not related to you but of the same race, and compared also to someone who's not related to you of another race, chances are that you're more similar to someone from another race than you are to someone within your own. And it just goes to emphasize the fact that at the genetic DNA level, there are very few differences between people. And it's this way that biology has classed the idea of race as a social rather than a biological construct. But in recent years, the question of the biological relevance of race has reemerged. And one example is this is comes from recent approval of by the FDA of a drug designed specifically for people of African origin only, and for those suffering from heart disease within that racial group. The drug is called isosorbide dinitrite and hydrolazine, and it uses the trade name Bidil, spelled B-I-D-I-L. And although it was rejected by the FDA in 1997, it became the first race-based prescription drug in the United States to be approved by the FDA in 2005. And in this way, this drug supports the notion that race does have a biological element. I mean, if you can design a drug that's specific for a particular racially divided group, then that proposes that the drug is acting on a biological level in a way that's unique to that particular group. It had been established that African Americans with heart disease did not respond well to commonly used treatments for congestive heart failures, And then this new drug combination significantly reduced mortality, hospitalizations, and other markers of life quality in Afro-American patients with heart disease. And despite the health benefits of this treatment strategy, this raises significant concern that the findings related to this drug can be used to support racist thinking. Firstly, if the drug is simply a combination of two previously approved drugs into one pill, so two drugs that had previously been approved by the FDA were combined to make this drug that was so effective in the African-American community of people suffering from heart disease. And consequently, many people would argue that the lower pill burden, so in this case, having only to take one pill instead of two, is a sort of strategy that's likely to lead to improved compliance and thus lead to improved health outcomes. So perhaps it's not actually the biological activity of the drug, but really more the treatment strategy with lower pill burden. Some also would argue that Biddle is actually a marketing breakthrough in which two low-cost drugs are combined into one pill at a greater cost to the consumer. Furthermore, Bildel has been patented, and the FDA has issued a statement that there are no other substitutes for this huge population of black individuals suffering from heart disease. So they're really forced and channeled into the purchase of this drug in order to treat their condition. And another suspicious feature about this drug is that it has only been approved for African-American patients, without the data to suggest that this is a valid limitation on its application. So I think this is an interesting example of the re-emergence of racial issues in the biological field, where it has previously been argued that there is no biological relevance, no biological data to support that there are differences between races. But I don't want to harp on negative interpretations of these issues, particularly since the drug has clearly improved the health of thousands of people. And you can actually read a lot more around that subject at a website that comes out of University of Toronto's History Department. And that group there in Toronto is called RACESCI, R-A-C-E-S-C-I, and it can be accessed by going to racesci.org. So what I really want to do in the next few minutes is draw your attention to some of the great inventions and scientific contributions of a number of black individuals, mostly in North America, who, for all kinds of reasons, were prevented from free access to education and equal opportunity. And it's this obstacle that has clearly been overcome that makes their achievements and contributions even more spectacular. So beginning with inventions, and prior to the Civil War, I should mention that free blacks, unlike those who were enslaved, were allowed to receive patents for their work, has permitted a significant emergence of inventors prior to the Civil War. For example, Thomas Jennings was the first African-American to receive a patent, and that occurred in 1821, and his patent was for the development of the dry cleaning process. Another individual, Norbert Rilieu, developed an evaporator for the use of refining sugar in 1846, and that approach to refining sugar is still used today. Another slave at the time, Benjamin Bradley, was working at the Annapolis Naval Academy, where he developed a steam engine for a warship in 1840. As I mentioned, at that time he was a slave and therefore ineligible for patenting, but he sold his invention and used the money to buy his freedom. And another anecdote with a bit of a Canadian flavor is Elijah McCoy, who was born in Canada and the son of an escaped slave, and he is known for having invented a lubricator system for steam engines and acquired 57 patents over the course of his life. As for scientists, two of the most famous African-American scientists are the mathematician and astronomer Benjamin Banneker and the chemist George Washington Carver. Banneker was born free in Maryland and is known for having produced the first striking clock. He was born in 1731. Furthermore, he published an almanac based on his own astronomical observations and also helped survey the boundaries for Washington, D.C. Carver, on the other hand, was born into slavery at the very end of the Civil War, yet managed to study at Iowa State College, where he earned a degree in agricultural science. During his career as a researcher and educator, he advocated innovative agricultural methods and developed hundreds of applications for agricultural products like the peanut. And additionally, in 1893, Dr. Daniel Hale Williams became the first doctor to successfully perform open heart surgery. More recently, Dr. Richard Drew, who earned his advanced degrees at McGill University in Montreal, is noted for his research in blood plasma and for setting up the first blood bank. Finally, and in preparation for some of the animal stories that I have picked out to come up next, you know, I do have a soft spot for that family known as insects. Charles Henry Turner, a black American from Ohio, was a noted authority on the behavior of insects. And in the early 20th century, he was the first researcher to prove that insects can hear. Vintage Sesame Street, and another Montessori brand children's song about ladybugs. And the final one there was the Ladybug Picnic, which might bring back some wonderful or possibly horrific memories from your childhood. But what's kind of neat about ladybugs is that they've recently been caught picnicking at elevations of up to 2,500 meters. In fact, atop Mount Etna, overturned rocks reveal hundreds of ladybugs crawling around on top of each other, but what the heck are they doing? There's only a few hypotheses out there, and in truth, nobody really knows what they're doing at such high elevations. But the first possibility is that the ladybugs had landed on the mountain during their biannual migration between Europe and North Africa. So in the fall and spring, ladybugs are on the move. Another possibility was that they were simply hibernating, but of course, the timing of the sighting of these ladybugs would really indicate whether that is a relevant hypothesis or not. And finally, the ladybugs may have been brought up to the peak by currents of warm air flowing up from lower slopes, but of course that begs the question of how the heck do they get back down again if they're constantly being buoyed up by warm air. So like I said, really, nobody really knows how these ladybugs got up there, but they're really getting around everywhere. And the confession here is that I really love ladybugs. I got into them long before I learned that many cultures bestow them with good luck. My mom and I share a crazy obsession with these little buggy creature things. In fact, to the degree that we send each other stickers and pins and postcards and facts that are all centered around the ladybug theme. Actually, we're even trying to compete on this ladybug obsession. We try to outdo each other with the extreme of the ladybug gesture. For example, sometime during my undergraduate studies at McGill University, I received a letter in the mail containing nothing but a few ladybugs from my mother. Unfortunately, they don't travel very well in an envelope, so it wasn't the most lively of gifts that one could receive in the mail. But that was definitely a time when the victory trophy was in her hands. And it wasn't until earlier this year that I was able to win it back when I found what amounts to ladybug porn and sent it her way. And so I think I won back our unhealthy obsession trophy with a simple link to a YouTube video of ladybugs mating. So I don't know, maybe I'm revealing a little too much about myself, but I think this next story is a trump card that I'm going to keep hidden until the challenge from my mother reaches a new height. And it's a story that might give you reason to reaffirm your awe of ladybugs. So to start off the question, I guess I would begin with a question. That question is a ladybug or a ladybird a ladybug, even if it's a male insect? Ladybugs certainly have one of the most gender-specific names on file, and it bears mentioning that ladybugs possess the ultimate feminist weapon of all time. They carry a bacteria that turns infected males into females in some species, and in other species, it prevents males from being born altogether. Now, don't worry, it's not contagious or infectious in the human population. Don't get excited. But the name of this bacteria is Wolbachia, and as far as scientists can tell, it can infect most insect groups, most major groups of invertebrates, and has been found everywhere from Panama to New York City to Russia. But why would a bacteria pick on male insects? You'd think that it would be kind of nice to have both genders around. But basically, it boils down to the fact that male sperm cells have very little cytoplasm, and that's the place where the Wolbachia likes to live. On the other hand, female insect eggs possess large cytoplasm, so in other words, large areas of homing space for the bacteria Wolbachia. And that's where it resides, and that's how the bacteria is ferried and passed on to the next generation. Consequently, if the bacteria infects the female, it will be passed on to future offspring. Whereas with the male, since the bacteria is unable to find a home, to find space for living, it dies before it's being passed on. So from the bacterial point of view, it's really no good to be in a male. It means certain death for the Wolbachia bacteria. Hence the sneaky strategies that I mentioned before about just eliminating the males altogether to preserve the bacterial survival. So one strategy is that the bacteria can interfere with hormone production in the developing embryo, and it can interfere with that hormone production in such a way that male gonads develop into ovaries. Thierry Rigaud at the University of Poitiers has identified a single hormone that leads to the development of male gonads in woodlice, another species that is infected by Wolbachia. Woodlice are similarly susceptible, like I said, to Wolbachia, and his team is attempting to determine how the bacteria interferes with that single hormone. And in that particular case, it's quite a lucky model system to study, because gender development at the pre-birth level is not usually as simple as a single hormone, but in this case it is, and it's certainly an interesting way to study how male and female woodlice develop. Wolbachia can also have a similar effect on the adult male, promoting the development of female genitalia. So this is not something that necessarily has to occur before birth. Infection of the adult male with Wolbachia can lead to female genitalia production, or if feminization isn't possible, the bacteria try to eliminate male offspring altogether by killing or preventing their birth. In fact, it was demonstrated that a certain species of Californian wasps produce mostly male offspring until bacteria killing antibiotics are introduced into their environment. Then more males are born. So this demonstrates that the bacteria really do have a strong control over the ratio of males to females being born in the Californian wasps. Well, Bakke's got all kinds of other tricks in its book. The bacteria, when not busy killing males, can prevent males from mating with uninfected females. All this adds up to some interesting side effects for evolution. A leading Wolbachia researcher by the name of Jack Warren at Rochester University has shown that infection of different insect populations with different strains of Wolbachia can present a species barrier. In Warren's lab, it was observed that with three strains of wasp allowed to mate with each other, they did not produce hybrid offspring, and only produce offspring when mating with their own strain. However, if that mating between three strains of wasps took place in the presence of antibiotics, so in the presence of a chemical or drug that would inhibit the growth of Wolbachia, hybrid progeny were produced. So this suggests a really interesting new layer to the definition of species. In other words, you can have species divides based on infection with such bacteria as Wolbachia, get rid of the bacteria, and those species begin back to merge into one when they can cross-pollinate, so to speak, or mate with each other. So research continues on in this exciting field, and of course I've got my eye on it very carefully, looking for ever crazier and ever more shocking facts about the ladybug, but certainly these new findings promise to teach us a lot about fertility, gender designation, and even pest control.
This is beautiful downtown Burbank.
Well, Max, headquarters. Headquarters. Chaos.
An audio magazine to be read with the ear.
Thursday nights at 11.
I saw the sign, so I removed the other eye.
Laugh Tracks, a show about comedy.
A cheerful change from the humdrum morning fair.
We didn't come from monkeys, you atheistic pinko meatheads.
Oh, Mr. President, hey, oh, hey.
Thank you, Mr. Bale.
Every Thursday night on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
I'm beginning to feel like a nut.
That's small.
Hi, I'm Anne, and you've been listening to my science project on CITR 101.9 FM. And we just spent a little time talking about ladybugs, a personal favorite of mine, and even more a favorite now that I've learned a little bit about the bacteria they carry and how those bacteria can lead to, well, feminization of males. And what you just heard was The Mooch by Duke Ellington, which is a little bit of late-era prohibition jazz. And I chose that because in the next piece, I did a little bit of research about methanol and blindness. And the reason that I did that was that I worked with a Swedish scientist here at UBC for a couple of years, and she was famous for her stories of the long, dark winter in northern Sweden, where parties were fueled by laboratory moonshine, blueberry pies, and polar dips. Of course, I would never advocate making laboratory moonshine. But anyway, to make this said moonshine, what you need to procure is 100% ethanol from the lab and mix it, most usually in a bathtub, with your favorite mixer. But it's a risky endeavor, not just because the use of 100% ethanol is carefully monitored by labs and the university, but because much of the ethanol available in the lab is not 100%. And when it's not 100%, it's usually 99% or 95% or occasionally 85%. But what it's mixed with, most commonly, is methanol. And the word on the street is that methanol can ruin the party because it will make you blind. Just like certain other things that are rumored to make you blind, the claim that methanol will make you blind sounds a bit like an urban legend that's been propagated to keep ethanol in the lab. So I wanted to know a little bit more. And what I found out is that, yes, indeed, methanol is a poison. And most simply, it's usually added to ethanol in order to avoid liquor tax on its sale. So ethanol that's not 100% is not taxed. But once again, much like ethanol, methanol is a depressant, and in its low doses actually has really similar effects to ethanol, making you drowsy, making you a little goofy, making you feel a little slow and mellow. And again, like ethanol can have its effect by ingestion, so can methanol by ingestion or inhalation or even absorption across the skin. Here are a couple of fun facts about methanol. Actually, a cloud of methanol 300 billion miles across, 300 billion miles across, cloud of methanol has been discovered in space. And the origin of the word methyl comes from two, one which is methy, meaning wine, and the other which is hyl, meaning tree or wood. Now, moving back to methanol as a toxin, when it's consumed in the liver, an enzyme known as alcohol dehydrogenase can break down methanol, but when it does that, it produces formic acid and formaldehyde. And these two things are what can cause blindness, and they do it when formic acid and formaldehyde moves towards the brain and damages the optic nerve. The usual fatal dose of methanol is about 100 to 125 milliliters, so that's like half a juice box. And 100 to 225 milliliters might be consumed if you drank 2 liters of laboratory moonshine, presuming it was made with about 95% ethanol by accident. So one antidote to the ingestion of methanol is actually to consume more 100% ethanol, believe it or not. And the reason why that is a good antidote is because ethanol competes with methanol for alcohol dehydrogenase. So if there's competition introduced, then less methanol will be able to be enzymatically broken down into its toxic components of formic acid and formaldehyde. And in this way, the kidney might be able to excrete the methanol before it's made into those nasty compounds and before those compounds accumulate, damaging the optic nerve. So I know it's dark and I know it's February and I know sometimes the best solution is to have a drink, maybe even one with your lab mates. But if you're desperate for a good time, beware the laboratory moonshine. Here is a little bit more of late prohibition jazz with the Jimmy Lunceford Orchestra.
About 3:30, my daddy said, son, come here to me. Says things may come and things may go, but this is one thing you ought to know.
Take what you do.
It's the way hot you do it.
Take what you do.
It's the way hot you do it.
Take what you do.
It's the way hot you do it.
That's what gets me so.
Mama, mama.
Take what you do.
It's the time that you do it.
Take what you do.
It's the time that you do it.
Think what you do.
It's the time that you do it.
That's what cares results.
Ooh.
You can't try hard. Don't mean a thing.
Don't mean a thing.
Take it easy.
Greasy.
Then your job will swing. Oh, and think what you do.
It's the place that you do it.
Think what you do.
It's the place that you do it.
Think what you do.
It's the place that you do it.
That's what cares results.
Tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CITR.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon?
Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out. Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset on Wednesday, February 20th, and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon. For more info, visit www.citr.ca.
To participate, dial 1-866-763-4136. Call toll-free.
They say you don't want people giving you too much?
No, well, you know what? See, like, when you panhandle, people like you to come off with some clever kind of saying. And it's really unique, because every individual's got what's going to make them laugh, and you may not even understand why they're laughing.
it is Dick Valentine from Electric Six. You're listening to CITR 101.9, University of British Columbia.
When a problem needs a problem solver, guess who gets the call? Me, asshole. You're tuned in with a black revolver. Guess who dropped the ball? The writing's on the wall. The president of the Capitol Lady loves the Senate Green. From New York to Los Angeles and all points in between. Burning 50 million megawatts of gasoline.
You're listening to My Science Project, and you just heard a little late-age prohibition jazz from the early 40s. That was Jimmy Lunceford Orchestra with Taint What You Do. And following on from that, I played a little more Mad Professor, and that tune was Great Hop Dub. Now, usually I run out of time when I get to this point in the show, and I want to tell you about all these events that are going around on around town, and usually I'm just rushing through them all. But there's lots happening right now. I'm going to take my time and tell you all about them. So, first of all, here is an event targeted at all women in undergraduate science, engineering, and technology. And it's being run by SWIST, which is the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology. And the evening is called XX, and it is a networking event at TELUS World of Science, taking place on Tuesday, March 4th, 2008. And this will be an opportunity for undergrads in science, engineering, and technology to network with and chat with women who have already made careers in science and technology. It costs $12 to get in, and the fee covers refreshments. Usually they serve pizza, drinks, and they're also going to show one of the IMAX films at Science World. So that's a great event to help you figure out what you might want to do with yourself and your science degree down the road on March 1st at Science World. You can get more information about that by checking out the SWIST website. So that's SCWIST. Have a look at their website to find out more. And the Student Biotechnology Network is having another career conference and expo. In fact, it's their fourth career conference and expo being held in here at Vancouver. So I guess it's the time of year to start thinking ahead to your careers and what you might be up to in September of this year. And so next Wednesday, February 13th, at the Weston Bayshore in Vancouver from 5 to 9 p.m., this event will take place. And it features breakout sessions on a few things, on, for example, employer expectations and how to pass the human resources test, how to hang up your lab coat and consider things that you never thought you could do with a science degree, and finally, exceptional experiences, how internships can change your life. There are a number of people there willing to act as mentors, and there are mentorship sessions, and also a keynote address by Krista Green, and the title of her talk is Branding Yourself, How to Stand Out in a Competitive Job Market. So that's another career conference hosted by SBN, the Student Biotechnology Network. And another pretty crazy thing is that Science World is getting sexy on us here. They have another Science After Dark series, adults only, which right then and there sounds pretty saucy if you ask me, but this one is called How to Play, and it's being held on Saturday, February 9th from 6 to 10 p.m., and the byline says you're never too old to play, and Science World promises to get you in the mood for Valentine's Day with delicious British Columbia wines, delightful Purdy's chocolates, and playful lessons in passion from the renowned sex therapist Dr. Cheryl Fraser. So it's an event, an evening of sensuousness, and it's open to singles and couples alike and individuals from all sexualities. It's $60 per guest, and that price includes appetizers, chocolates, wine, treats, and you have to be over 19 to go. To get more information about that, you can call 604-443-7500, or you can email to buy tickets at buytix@scienceworld.ca. That's B-U-Y-T-I-X. Now, I've got another unconventional suggestion for you. And what I'm going to suggest is that maybe you think about going to church on Sunday, because this Sunday, February 10th, is Evolution Sunday. Darwin's date of birth was actually February 12th, 1809, but Evolution Sunday has been celebrated now since 2006, so just a couple of years now. But the story of how Evolution Sunday came to be, for those of you who don't know, is kind of an interesting and fun story. So at a time in the United States when the intelligent design versus evolution debate was in high gear, Michael Zimmerman, who's a biologist at Butler University, decided he was going to take some action. And what he did was he called up a friend in the clergy and encouraged him to draft and sign a letter. This became known as the Clergy Letter Project, and it actually has its own website. The letter's message can be summarized by a quote from it. Excuse me. As I was saying, the letter's message can be summarized by a quote taken directly from it. And that quote is, "We believe that the theory of evolution is a foundational scientific truth, one that has stood up to rigorous scrutiny." Within a month of writing that letter, 200 clergy members had signed that letter, and over the next year, about 10,000 clergy members from around the world would add their names, many signing it to make it clear that there were other perspectives on science other than those of the conservative fundamentalist Christians who were strongly against science and had the most vocal public voice at the time. Then, to give religious leaders an opportunity to bring their views to their congregations, Zimmerman proposed the idea of Evolution Sunday, which is essentially a day to discuss the compatibility of science and religion. And in 2006, 467 congregations participated, and then by 2007, that had gone up to 618, where those subjects were presented in the context of a church sermon. So this Sunday may actually prove to be an interesting day to go to church. So, I don't know, maybe consider it. I did a quick look around Vancouver and found that the Center for Spiritual Living in Vancouver, which is guided by Reverend Mary K. Ducey, will be addressing these issues on Sunday. So I don't know, maybe give it a thought, or at least maybe check out the Clergy Letter Project and see what you think. Now, since it seems like I'm about to die from a coughing attack, I'm just going to play a little bit more music and come back to you shortly.
Radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh in the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite
indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the pop underground, Thursdays noon to one.
I think I've recovered from coughing spasms. And before I go, and before I hand you off to Darren and his Asteroscopic Redoubt show, I wanted to let you know that there's a new CBC project called Project X. And what it is a television show, a half-hour slot, that's going to be happening on Thursday, starting next Thursday, and every Thursday for a little bit longer after that. And it's a sort of a science magazine show. What's kind of neat about it is that it's going to feature a postdoc from University of British Columbia as one of the co-hosts. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Gardy. She comes from the Bob Hancock Lab, who is a microbiologist here at the university. And yeah, she's going to be the co-host. So check that out. It's Project X, premiering next Thursday, February 14th at 7:30 p.m. Like I said, it's a science magazine show meant to be a little bit offbeat, meant to shake up the sort of David Suzuki trends of the CBC. And actually, on February 21st, it will feature an episode and the research of Bob Hancock himself. So that's, I think, going to be a great thing to check out. Local news, local feature, and possibly down the road we'll get a chance to meet with Jennifer Gardy herself. So yeah, like I said, we've got Stereoscopic Readout coming up. I'm going to leave you with a final song from OMD. That song's called Genetic Engineering, one of their big ones. And you will be joined in 2 weeks' time by Julia, who is expecting to do a show, a little bit of roundup of stories about love in honor of Valentine's Day, which is next Thursday. So tune in for that and check it out. And in the meantime, thanks for joining me. I'm Anne. This is My Science Project. See you soon.
Designing.